know you are gluttons for punishment. Those of you who have returned, happy to see you again, and those who are just arriving, welcome. I do want to point out to you, I've left my coat off because, being a large man like Falstaff, I perspire a lot. Some of my favorite lines in Henry IV, Part 1, Falstaff sweats to death and lards the lean earth as he walks along. I've always felt particularly close to him, so I've got my coat off. But I'm also pointing out I have a different shirt and tie. Those of you that were here last night will have to explain it to the newcomers. Just very quickly, what I give you a sense of what's going to go on in this long day for all of you, I'm afraid. Feel free to flee at any time. But what I'm going to talk about first is, it's going to take me a long while to get into my discussion of Pericles. Because what I want to talk about is the nature of the romances as they are defined almost as a separate category of play. And I'm going to try to give as they're difficult to define, but being traditional Catholics and therefore respecting Thomistic philosophy, which takes us back to Aristotle, if you don't define things, then you can't talk about anything. So I'm going to spend a good bit of time just trying to make clear for you at least how I'm dealing with the word romance, what it means. Those last four plays, which are very unusual, very different from anything else Shakespeare wrote before, and I'm going to make the claim, very different from what almost anyone else has ever written at any time. I believe they're unique, absolutely unique, and I'll try to get to that. See, it's a long time for me to even get to the beginning, so I'm going to cover that, get into that, then we'll look at Pericles. I hope to touch on Cymbeline, but I'm at the mercy of time. Then we'll take a break, then we'll have a discussion. Feel free to ask anything you want, talk about whatever you would like, and then there'll be another break. And then I'm going to talk about The Winter's Tale and give you some new information that I have come upon that's not yet been revealed anywhere. This is news. The London Times should be here covering it. They don't care. But basically, what I hope to do is talk a bit about Claire Asquith's book, too, because my understanding is the British press is being much crueler to the book than the American press was. And I don't often stand in defense of the American press, but on this occasion I will. So I'll talk a bit about that book as well. So that's what's coming. And meanwhile, or perhaps consistently, visit the bar as often as possible. I myself am... You see, you're looking at me, I see one thing that says Cobra. It says Cobra. I'm longing for a little bit of that snake bite. So, now, here's another one of White's crackpot theories that I came up with years ago. But I'm now so convinced of it that I don't even call it crackpot anymore. Merely a theory. Seems to work out. Seems to be well tested, and while I can't discuss it in at the university where I teach, I try to get the word out wherever I can because I think it's very useful in understanding Shakespeare's career. And it's simply this: the movement of ideas and genres, styles of play that Shakespeare wrote throughout his career resembles almost exactly, in parallel form, the Mysteries of the Rosary. Let me explain this. Being traditional Catholics, we know that the Rosary is given to us through three sets of mysteries. And they come in a particular order, and throughout the week we pray them in a particular order. As with everything in our beloved faith, there is a profound reason and truth to that order. And therefore, as the week begins, we begin with the joyful mysteries. As the week proceeds, we pray the sorrowful mysteries. And then we round out our praying of the rosary with the glorious mysteries. Shakespeare's career begins with the comedies, goes through the tragedies, and ends with the romances. It is a movement from joy to sorrow to glory. It is almost an exact parallel to the mysteries of the rosary. Why should it be this way? Because there is an inherent human logic in that development. It makes perfect sense that this young playwright, who was very successful and given very real gifts, as a young man coming to London, had his first great successes with some history plays. There are history plays scattered throughout. But it's interesting, his greatest comic character, Sir John Falstaff, occurs in the Henry IV plays written at the same time that he's writing the comedy. So it's part of that in a way. Although we certainly have earlier tragedies of Richard III, Richard II. I'm looking at the larger scope, the larger span. Why begin with the comedies? Why were his first huge successes? Comedy of Errors, Taming of the Shrew, comedies? Because when we are young, we, for the most part, are experiencing or should be experiencing the joys of life. It's the time of discovery. It's the time of a kind of carefreeness. The sorrows and weight of the world have not yet landed on us. We're growing up. We're getting a sense of who we are. We're puppies who are about to become young dogs and enjoying that feeling. We're finding out who we are, what we can do in the world. We're falling in love. The world is our oyster. And everything is there before us, and that is absolutely appropriate. Now, what the Shakespeare comedies teach us, as I was trying to point out last night, is that in and of itself is not easy. There are still tensions. There are still problems. The individual running up against the social order, there is conflict. It is not easy, but still, we believe in the possibility of compromise, everything working out, life will be beautiful. And it's there is that lovely freshness that is the freshness of youth. Now, I don't want to spoil anything for those of you who are young, but let me just say it doesn't last. As time comes on and experiences accumulate, the weight of the world begins to wear us down. And you begin to realize that that early vision of joy and the freshness begins to disappear, and responsibility and real conflict and our own sins become heavier and weightier, and then we are struck with that fact that has loomed over tragedy from the beginning, the reality of death. If life is so joyful and wonderful, then why is man made to die? And that question hangs over us, or an even worse question, if love is one of the supreme aspects of the joy of living, then why must we lose those we love to death? And when we're hit with the reality of those questions and have to deal with them seriously, life becomes the veil of tears that we are told it is. And we know it is that. And when that first comes upon us, we have to, if you will, work our way through that veil of tears, try to understand it intellectually and emotionally, try to understand how we keep going in the face of that, by the way, a huge sorrow of our time. is that many young people, being denied the freshness of a childhood, come upon sorrow when they are too young to handle it, and hence the explosion in suicide among young people. There it is. There's a reason for it. They are being hit with the realities of life long before they're ready for it, or have had the joys to hold them up for a while, to keep them going. And of course, no one's telling them anything about the higher truths. All I can say is that will increase. That will increase. There's no getting around it. So sadly, that sorrow is there. You're going to confront it. You cannot escape it. And when it hits, you must work your way through it. Shakespeare moves into those magnificent plays, unequaled. Everyone says, and I think it's true in a way, that they are the glories of English literature. Hamlet, Othello, King Lear, Macbeth, extraordinary studies of the fact of evil in the world, the fact that man is a fallen creature and will choose to fall of his own free will, and the consequences. But that is never the end. Now, here's what's very odd, and this is why I say the romances are unique. Tragedy is the rarest form that you can find in literature. It is very, very difficult to write a great tragedy, and that's why there are so few of them. There are only a couple of times, when there have been periods of great tragedies written for the stage. The Greeks, that glorious period in Athens, they gave us Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides, extraordinary. And then tragedy as a form did not blossom again until the Elizabethan era. Right here in England, tragedy reasserts itself. It's almost unbelievable. We are talking 2,000 years later, tragedy comes back as a form. Medieval writers could not write tragedy. Why not? Because they were so immersed in the Catholic faith. If you are profoundly Catholic from the get-go, you can understand it's a veil of tears and deal with sorrow, but you don't have a vision of tragedy. Shakespeare was raised by a Catholic family in a country that was determined to destroy that faith. And he obviously went through doubts, questioning, despair, trying to figure out what is going on here, what do I believe, what is happening, and produces great tragedy. That monumental form with gigantic characters. The golden age of Spanish drama. Wonderful Spanish playwrights. Thousands of interesting plays. They didn't write tragedy. Why not? Because Spain was a devoutly Catholic culture. Didn't occur to them. Wasn't really in them. When does tragedy next appear? In the 19th century. In the novel. In Russia. Dostoevsky. Maybe, I might be stretching it here, maybe Tolstoy's Anna Karenina. Certainly, the one great American work. We don't have much to put up. I'm sorry. I've got to be honest. As I say to my students, when the last golden arch falls in the dust, and when the last screen flickers off down to a little dot and disappears, America will be remembered for two things and two things only. One, we were the nation that stepped off the planet. We put a man on the moon. An extraordinary accomplishment. Extraordinary accomplishment. But that is because we had a lot of money and engineering skills and all worshipped in the temple of science. And the other thing we'll be remembered for is a book about a whale. And Moby Dick is the one American work of art that ranks with all the greats of world literature, and very few Americans have ever read it. I was actually on the radio just last week. Somebody posted a poll, what is the great American novel? And listed 25 novels. And the host of the radio show that I appear on once a month on his website put up a big thing that said, Dr. David Allen White would say Moby Dick. And then he got me on the air that night, and I said, yes, I'd say Moby Dick, and in fact, there are only two or three others on the list that are worth reading. Well, fortunately, I came over here because the email was just horrible. How can you read that book? How is it? I can't make head or tail out of it. What are you talking about? But it's to your credit. No American publisher would publish it. It was first published in England. So there you are. But then you folks have known something about literature. You've got a tradition of it. We didn't. It's a tragedy. Captain Ahab is a tragic figure. There is a fall. It has consequences. A ship goes down. Bloop, 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 bloop. His Excellency knows, because I've often said this, I sincerely believe my poor country is like the Pequod. It's going and going and going and going, and there's a madman at the helm, and then all of a sudden it gets nailed, boom, and down it goes, and that's it. I fear we're getting closer and closer. I say in sorrow. Tragedy is a rare form. Tragedy is a very, very rare form. Meaning, very few writers ever have a chance to go beyond it, because most writers never get there to begin with. I only know really of one other circumstance where a writer of tragedy gave us a glimpse of something beyond it. The last two Sophocles plays, Philoctetes and Oedipus at Colonus. If you don't know them, I recommend them. Sophocles is a very old man. Did not, obviously, have the faith. He couldn't. The incarnation had not yet taken place. But he intuits there is something beyond sorrow. There is something beyond grief. And you cannot get through it unless you go through a period of intense suffering. Once again, those Greeks, using logic and the knowledge of the human heart in order to come to a profound mystery and put it down, even though they couldn't fully understand it. But there it is. Recommend those two plays if you don't know them. The only other case I know of a great tragic writer moving beyond tragedy. Shakespeare moved beyond tragedy. His tragic period ends with Coriolanus. Coriolanus is the end of his tragic vision. Someday I'll give a lecture on that and try to explain why it stops there. He could not write another tragedy after Coriolanus. He resolved the problem. What does he write next? What does he write next? Plays of glory. Paralleled what I would call the glorious mysteries. Now let me make an admission to you. When I pray the joyful mysteries, I have some sense of what the nature of joy is about. I can comprehend it. I've been so blessed in my own life that there are aspects of the joyful mysteries that correspond in some way to my own life, puny as my life may be, in comparison to the greatness of those mysteries. But I certainly can understand the joy of a coming birth. The joy of visiting a relative who has also had some joy just visited on them. The glory of birth itself. I'm just speaking in secular terms. Obviously, we know the mysteries are much higher. But I'm just saying, we have simple life experiences. Experiences, if you will, in nature, as His Excellency was saying this morning, in nature, they give us some sense of those higher joyful mysteries. The glories of birth. The glory of finally submitting to walk into the temple and do your duty. I'll tell you, after years of wandering around and crawling through a desert and finding myself lost and alone, when I walked into that Catholic church to be received into the church and submitted to Holy Mother Church, joy. I can't tell you what that felt like. That's joy. And then the discovery of wisdom coming from beyond, or where you least expect it, or the reunion of the family, or the family coming back together and just living. I can grasp all that. And heaven knows I can grasp sorrow. That sense of being lost and alone and abandoned and knowing what you're going to face. Physical suffering. Humiliation. Knowing that death is approaching. None of us will ever grasp anything of the immensity of Christ's suffering, but we know what it is to suffer in our own small way. And we know we are called to fill up the sufferings of Christ. We know we are told to pick up our cross and follow Him. So we know something like it in our puny way. We can understand sorrow. As I pray the joyful mysteries and the sorrowful mysteries, I can connect. But to be honest with you, I do not yet understand glory. I don't know. Haven't been there yet. Can't quite imagine. I pray it dutifully in hope that one day, even though I see now through a glass darkly, I will eventually see face to face. But I haven't seen it yet. And the one place I turn to try to get a sense of what that glory might be like is the romances of William Shakespeare, the last four plays. What does that mean then? What is in those glorious mysteries that he begins to capture in these very mysterious last plays? And they are so mysterious that for hundreds of years, critics have ruled them failures. Or claim he was experimenting, didn't know what he was doing. My favorite is a comment on Cymbeline, where A.L. Rouse in a commentary said it was obvious Shakespeare had a stroke and had no command anymore. That's how strange these plays are. That's how critics deal. He'd lost it. He was experimenting. He had a stroke. Who knows what he was doing? These things are weird. No, they're not. He's simply ahead of us, showing us something we can't yet grasp or hope to grasp. What is in the glorious mysteries? Very quickly, please notice that almost every one of the glorious mysteries is about rising or falling, ascending or descending. We have Christ rising from the dead. We have Christ ascending into heaven. We have the Holy Ghost descending upon the apostles and the Blessed Mother. We have the Blessed Mother assumed into heaven, and then we end up there with this most perfect of all human creatures being crowned the Queen of Heaven. And it's a vision of humanity in its ultimate perfection, not just being allowed in, but this most perfect virgin and mother becoming the Queen of Heaven and Earth. What the glorious mysteries are about on one level is this mysterious connection of humanity and the divine, of nature and supernature, back and forth, overcoming death, ascending to heaven, the third person of the Trinity descending to us, Mary, the perfect human creature, being assumed into heaven, up and down, up. What the glorious mysteries are asserting is the connection, the bond, that for much of our lives we don't fully grasp, but when we see clearly, when death is overcome, apparently we will know that connection. Shakespeare will be obsessed with this idea in the romances. The connection between heaven and earth. The interplay between heaven and earth. It's everywhere. What else do we get there? Get the absolute, and this goes back to what I started to talk about last night. The absolute, essential, crucial role of the woman. Not that Mary has not been there before. Clearly she is. The Annunciation, the Visitation, the Nativity, Presentation in the Temple, the Discovery of the Child, she's there for all of them. She is there watching her son on the way to Calvary. She is there at the foot of the cross. But please notice, as the glorious mysteries go along, the women go to the tomb and then go out and report what is there. They are not there when Christ ascends into heaven. I don't think we have any record of that. But Mary is there in the upper room as the Holy Spirit descends. And then the last two mysteries are hers. They are hers. They are focused on her. At the end of all this, of all 15 mysteries, 14 and 15 are focused on the Blessed Mother. The Mother, the Virgin, the Queen is central. It is the reward. It is the reward for her maintaining through all of that all that she had been given and promised and performed with perfection. Because she loved God. We cannot imagine glory without the good woman. And the good woman is fully human. Fully human. She's one of us. It's the reason last night I made the point that when a hero rises from the dead at the end of Much Ado About Nothing, we are getting a link between virginity, chastity, innocence, purity, and the resurrection. You cannot have one without the other. They are intimately linked together. And when in that little song she is referred to as a virgin knight, it suggests that the power and strength and glory of the woman is in her goodness, in her imitation of the Blessed Virgin. And that that is a force in the world stronger than evil or time or corruption, you name it. There is no destructive force on earth that will not crumble before the presence of the Blessed Mother. Shakespeare knew it. And the last plays are filled with good women. Loaded with good women. We just mentioned briefly last night, the most difficult thing in the world to do in literature is present a good character. Why is it so difficult? Because in worldly terms, they're not interesting. The world doesn't care. The world is much more interested. And you hear this all the time, I'm sure. The newspapers, the TV news, all that. Why don't you ever report good stories? There are so many happy things out there. I turn on the news at night, and it's just terrible. It's war and destruction and murder and car wrecks. Why don't you ever report anything that's nice? The reason is they know that our ratings would fall off to zero. It's part of our fallen nature. We prefer that other stuff. But the other reason is this. It is very easy for an evil character to be openly evil. Shakespeare's Richard III. Play opens with a soliloquy. This humpbacked, evil would-be king comes out on stage and says to the audience, "I'm wicked. Here's what I'm going to do. Watch me." And we go, okay? Iago, at the beginning of the play, takes us into his confidence. All the way along, he's telling us, "Now watch me, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. Oh, watch me do this." And we watch and we go, "Oh." Until it gets really ugly, and then we think, that's not good. Oh, we don't like that. But he's taken us into his confidence. Why? Because evil can know what it's doing. And at its grimmest, watch itself do it. That's horrifying. That's horrifying. The good cannot put itself forward. That which is genuinely good will be modest and unassuming. You cannot have a good character come out on stage and say, now watch me, I'm going to be good. Because at that moment, the character is not good. It's called pride. So you can't do it. So the creative artist has a real problem. How do you present a good character that's good and interesting? A couple of people have done it wonderfully. One of them, I go to Dostoevsky again. Those of you that know the Brothers Karamazov. Young Alyosha committed to old Father Zosima. And Father Zosima is a good character. And how do we know he's good? He says nothing about himself, but he talks endlessly about God and Christ because that's what he's supposed to do. He does what he's supposed to do. We see it reflected in the young monk who is, if you will, a attempting to live and be as good as his mentor, and we get a glimpse of the good. It's fascinating. It's fascinating. In Shakespeare, in the romances, how do we get it? We get it in the fact of women who undergo tremendous suffering, either through events in the world, lies put upon them, or attempts on their virtue, who remain unsullied and unmoved and uncomplaining. It's astonishing. It's astonishing. And what happens in the romances is that we watch the good move through the world in a series of scenes, a number of different actions, and survive to the end. Survive to the end and are somehow better for having gone through the process. If I may steal a remark from the Easter sermon of my own dear parish priest, I'm blessed with a great priest. He's an independent, a friend of the society. His name is Father Ringrose. He made the point that when Christ rises from the dead, he has a glorified body. We speculate on what it is. We know certain characteristics of it. We know it is not fallible like our human body. It is a remarkable thing. But it has all the scars on it. The wounds are there. The glorified body carries the wounds. And we know that somehow if we make it to glory, we will come to glory with our wounds. If we took up that cross and followed Christ, then we too have been scourged and whipped and nailed to our cross and we are wounded. If we're coming to the end of our life and we don't have wounds, then we better be concerned. But if we have those wounds, it is not only that those wounds will be part of our glory, but we will be identified by those wounds. When Thomas doubts, the doubts end when he places his fingers in the wound. He knows our Lord by the wound. We will know who we are and recognize each other by our smaller, puny, but nevertheless Christ-like wounds. At the end of every one of Shakespeare's romances, which are plotted extensively, the plots are very complex. There's so much going on, it seems the plays are going to bubble over at times. The characters who have been lost, separated, I'll talk about this in a moment, recognize each other and finally know one another again by telling their stories. this happened to me, and then that happened to me, and then I was here, and this attempt was made on me, and then I suffered here. And the other party who has lost the beloved one says, then you must be... What are those? The wounds of living. And at the end, recognition takes place by wounds. When we come to glory, the glory will be our wounds. I'm leaping ahead to the very end of Pericles. He has lost his wife at sea. She gives birth in a storm at sea and dies as she gives birth. Because it's bad luck to have the corpse on the ship, they sealed in a coffin, and she goes off into the storm. And then his daughter, a baby, cannot continue the sea voyage. He stops at the nearest kingdom to whom he did good. They take the baby and promise to raise her. The jealous evil queen has her put to death, only she survives. But Pericles is told she's dead. He thinks his wife is dead. His daughter is dead. The coffin is found. A good magician named Cerimon, think ceremony, Cerimon, brings her back to life, and she goes to a convent and lives as a nun. The daughter goes through horrendous adventures, is taken into a brothel. They try to make a whore of her, and instead she converts the men coming to the brothel. Or just, I've got to pause and do this one. This is just too good. I'm finding this. Just give me a second. I like this. Come now, what's the matter? Says the bawd to the pander. The pander says, worse and worse, mistress. She has here spoken holy words to Lord Lysimachus. Oh, abominable. There's a wonderful moment when two noblemen leave the brothel. Did you ever hear the like? No, nor never shall do in such a place as this. She being once gone... But to have divinity preached there? Did you ever dream of such a thing? No, no. Come. I am for no more bawdy houses. Shall us go hear the Vestals sing? I'll do anything now that is virtuous, but I am out of the road of rutting forever. Goodness has power. All right? Anyway. Pericles thinks he's lost everything. He won't cut his hair. He's become mute. He's just sailing along on a vessel. Comes to this town, and they say, we should have this good young girl come and talk to him. She'll cheer him up. She does wonderful things. They bring this girl to him. She begins trying to talk to him. He ignores her because he's sunk in his grief and cannot see beyond the grief. And finally, he perks up and says to her, tell thy story. If thine considered prove the thousandth part of my endurance, thou art a man, and I have suffered like a girl. Please notice, you haven't suffered the way I've suffered. Nobody suffered the way I have suffered. Yet thou dost look like patience gazing on kings' graves, and smiling extremity out of act. What were thy friends? How lost thou them? Thy name, my most kind virgin. Recount, I do beseech you. Come sit by me. She says, my name is Marina. Oh, I am mocked. And thou, by some incensed god, sent hither to make the world laugh at me. Patience, good sir, here I'll cease. And she goes through the whole story. And moment by moment, it becomes clearer. It's his daughter who is dead. It cannot be. The reunion scene is so moving, you cannot bear it. I just saw this on stage earlier this year. Nicely done. Again, it depends on the production. There are crazies out there. I heard a production at the Globe down here that sounded abominable. You know, you're at the mercy of the performers. This was well done. The audience was sobbing. Why were they sobbing? Not out of sorrow. This is past sorrow. Out of the recognition that that which is lost can be recovered. That it's not lost forever. And fact that the entire painful experience has been designed pointing toward that happy ending, only we couldn't see it as we were living through it. How could we know? Now, this is true of all of the romances. We have that moment of recognition. The story. The loss being recovered. In order to do that, I'm realizing I'm running out of time. This is what happens. It's the fault of my mouth. It just runs and runs and runs. As I said, when I actually do die, they're going to have to beat my mouth to death with a stick. Let me just give you, and I'm stealing this from the introduction of F.D. Henniger, some points about defining romances. It's excellent. This is from, I don't know if you know the Arden Shakespeare. They're the scholarly texts. There are now three different versions of them. The first Arden that was put out, very good. If you can find them, they're still good. The second editions of the Arden, very good, re-edited, different scholars. They're well worth reading. A period of scholarship where scholars did their work. Even though when they came out, they put ghastly covers up. Unbelievable, hideous covers. This is Marina, the heroine. This is the good daughter in Pericles. Look at her. She's biting her lip. She's defiant, and she has her fist raised and clenched. She's about to go to a women's lib rally and get out of those hands. Just a, oh, this one. Oh, thank you. This is The Winter's Tale. It's from a soap opera. It's from a soap opera from TV. A moment of, they're just terrible. The one for Othello. He looks like a punch-drunk prize fighter who became a jazz musician and drank all there's not an ounce in there. Anyway, but the second editions are worth having. They're good. The third editions coming out now are insane. They are so insane to read it to get a good laugh. The things they are saying are so off the wall and crazy, you wouldn't... Fraternity boys on a drunken night making up nonsense couldn't have come up with stuff this bizarre. So, anyway, this is Mr. Henniger, and this is very good. Defining how the romance is unique. One, the kind of action or actions that are unlike other plays. Mentioned this yesterday. Character gives way to action. These are stories. We have the sense they are fairy tale-like. One thing, then another thing happens. It's not a profound look at, psychological look at deep characters. Why? Because, and this is T.S. Eliot's idea, in the late plays, Shakespeare was doing something dramatists hadn't done, putting spiritual states on stage. What you're seeing is not a character in the way we think of it. A human personality, you're seeing an aspect of soul. Something that is in the soul of a human being that's being dramatized. Very difficult to explain, other than let me do it this way. The plays are fairy tale-like. We were told in order to enter heaven we must become like little children again. A little child looking at the world or encountering stories will tell you immediately, will sum up immediately for you the spiritual state of what they're seeing. Oh, that's a bad man. Oh, that's a good person. I like that lady. Ooh, that's ugly. I don't like that. Now, that is pure childlike simplicity and innocence. It's just making absolute judgments. And children love fairy tales for that reason, because it's all very clear. The wicked witch is wicked. The princess is beautiful. The knight is noble, okay? The donkey is slow. I mean, it's just, boom, it's all right there. And the kid knows it. And then, I talked to a traditional couple. Married, they're friends, they married a little later in life. They're going to have children, they're very excited. And they heard one of my tapes where I said, you've got to read fairy tales. So they'd never read fairy tales. So they're sitting there and reading fairy tales aloud to each other. And the wife said to me, the most crazy things happen in them. I said, yes, that's part of the fun. She said, yes, we're not, we just take it for granted. They're going along, and then all of the, and then all of a sudden, then all of a sudden the toad turns into a prince. And we say, oh, well, yes. And children do that too with the world. It's just sort of, oh, that happened then? Oh, well, yes. Well, that's the way it is, I guess. And just add, now there's a wonderful moment in Pericles. The wicked queen is going to have Marina killed. She says to one of her servants, you take her out by the seashore and you kill her. He says, I don't want to do that. She's a good young woman. You do it, it's an order. You go, oh, okay, I'll go do it. So he takes her, he doesn't want to. He says, look, I've got to kill you now. She says, oh, please don't kill me, don't kill me. He says, I have no choice. If I don't kill you, then I'll be killed by the evil queen. And he draws his dagger, and the next stage direction is enter pirates. In the production, the director, and it was wonderful, we come to that moment and Marina is on her knees pleading for her life and the man has the dagger drawn and the chorus, and there's a chorus I'll mention in a moment in Pericles, walks on and says, enter pirates. And steps on stage, and got the pirates, one of them looking like Captain Hook. Which is perfect. Absolutely perfect. So we have a problem, how do we deal with it? More action. Enter pirates. But of course what we have is simply the storm of fortunes in the world. Marina at one point says, this world is as a lasting storm pouring me from my friends. And that's, life is, folks, as you well know, just one thing after another. And what Shakespeare does in the romances is make them big things. Another shipwreck, an attempted murder, a queen who becomes an evil queen. You know, it's just, what do you do? Most of us only have one or two big ones in our life. In the romances, they're coming nonstop. Because they are about action. Action takes precedent over character. Number two, we have a kind of double plotting. We don't just have one story in which we're following a set of characters. We have families, and they are generational. We have fathers and mothers, usually kings and queens, and the princes and princesses, the children. And the families are ripped apart, absolutely ripped apart. What Shakespeare understands in the romances, and is making clear, is that from joy through sorrow until finally the moments of glory, we should be with our families. They are the source of joy to us. As you all well know, they are the source of sorrow. And the dream and hope is that one day that family will be reunited in a perfect way with everyone like-minded. The jailer in Cymbeline who says at one point, would we were all of one mind and one mind good. And that's the dream. But what we really want is to be with our families. And then, of course, the beauty of our friends, our neighbors, our fellow Catholics, the saints, and it but it's the family first. Think of the tears you shed for it. Think of the moments of happiness when something good happens. It's family, and Shakespeare is there with it. Number three, the handling of time. The ideal was the play should run about the length of the performance. Now, Shakespeare would violate that. Ben Jonson criticized him for violating the unities. But he comes to these plays and forget the unities. Pericles takes place over about 16 years. The Winter's Tale over 14 years. By the way, Ben Jonson was so annoyed. Shakespeare violated every rule in Pericles, and it was an enormous hit, and Jonson referred to it as that moldy tale. But if you're going to look at the vast horizon and follow action, many actions over time, you need a lot of time. Now, The Tempest is a little different. The Tempest is unique. I'm talking mainly Pericles, Cymbeline, The Winter's Tale. Tempest is a romance a little bit different about it. That's for another time. The frightening shape and power of evil. The plays are often called tragicomedies. the plays move towards tragedy. All of the built-in evil of those tragedies appear in the romances and look as if they will, that evil is going to triumph, it doesn't. But in order to get to the end, the evil is there and it causes enormous disruptions in the lives of the characters. Everywhere. Man is the plaything of fortune or the gods. Pericles is not in one storm at sea, he's at two, and he's shipwrecked twice. It seems as if every time the man gets on a boat, boom, here comes another storm. And the image is finally, you know, has somebody got something against this man? Well, what is being asserted is, if you're living through the world, you're going to be battered by events. One thing after another. He makes them enormous events. Again, it only happens occasionally for us. And then this, let me just read it. The action of all the last plays is overshadowed by supernatural forces who seem to be willing to grant to the protagonists enduring happiness only after years of suffering. What I said earlier, you may have your happy ending, but not until you have gone through years of suffering. Not until you've carried that cross to the point where you can't bear the weight of it anymore. And if you endure, he who endures unto the end will be saved. And it's a test. This life is a test. And please notice, everything in the modern world is geared to avoid suffering. I've got a headache. Where's my pillow? I need time. Give me two Advil. I've got a stomachache. Where's the Pepto-Bismol? I've got this pain. I've got to go to the doctor. I've got something terrible. Cut it out. We don't want suffering. It's too hot. Turn the air conditioning on. It's too cold. Turn on the heat. I'm bored. Turn on the TV. We will not suffer for 1 minute. What is asserted in the romances is that unless you undergo that suffering, you're not going to get to that happy ending. It is by suffering you get to the happy ending. It's by enduring suffering. And that happy ending is beyond anything you could dream of. You could dream of. Let me end with this. I'll come back to this in the next lecture. The second of the romances is called Cymbeline. I did my doctoral dissertation on it. I knew it was a great play. I knew I loved it. I had no idea what to say about it. I wrote 240 pages. I should not have been given the degree. That's why I say PhD piled high in D. However, when I moved recently, I found a copy. I went through it. And out of the 240 pages, there are maybe half a dozen, six, eight pages where I see a young mind groping towards the truth. And it was worth it all in a way, but one thing I knew was what the play is criticized for. In Cymbeline, we don't have one plot, we've got three of them running simultaneously. We have so much plot in that play, it threatens to go out of control. Again, parents who have lost children and the king who has sent his daughter off and Rome is at war with Britain and a villain lies about the chastity of a wife and so her husband asks to have her killed. It's all going on. There's an evil queen who's taken over who sends her servant off again to kill the young heroine in the woods. It's all Snow White, friends. It's all Snow White. We don't have the seven dwarves, but it's Snow White. There's so much plot, you get to the end of the... You know this thing's got to end. You've been sitting there for 3 hours in the theater. And there's no way it can possibly end. There are so many plots going on, and it is so complex that it cannot possibly resolve itself. What happens? They just walk off the stage and we go home. And indeed... the dead parents of the hero rise up and accuse Jupiter. In every one of these plays, there's a theophany. A god descends or is heard. Diana in Pericles, Jupiter in Cymbeline, and the voice of Apollo in The Winter's Tale. A god enters the play. Well, Jupiter descends on an eagle because the ghosts, the parents of the hero and his brothers, all dead, are saying to Jupiter, why are you doing this to our son? Why are you doing this to our son? Don't you care? Well, as you know, being good traditional Catholics, but as some other Catholics, sadly, in high position don't know, you don't accuse God. Jupiter comes down, and the first thing he says is, no more, you petty spirits of region low, offend our hearing. Hush! How dare you ghosts accuse the thunderer? Pretty good stuff. Whose bolt, you know, sky-planted, batters all rebelling coasts. You rebel, and the bolts are coming down from heaven to get you. Pour shadows of Elysium hence, and rest upon your never-withering banks of flowers. I could stay here for hours and just talk about the poetry of these plays. This guy was the master of the English language, and the poetry in these plays is overwhelming. Be not with mortal accidents oppressed. No care of yours it is. You know 'tis ours. Whom best I love, I cross. To make my gift, the more delayed, delighted. Be content. Whom best I love, I cross. How do you know God loves you? Because he will send those crosses to you. If everything's going well and your life is just fine, look out! Whom best I love, I cross. The power of, well, what can you, I don't have to explain it. To make my gift the more delayed, delighted. Notice the phrasing. To make my gift the more delayed, comma, delighted. Oh, we got a great writer here. Whoa! Okay? Now, he basically says, it's all going to be taken care of. Go back to sleep, and they say, fine, sorry, Jupiter. It's okay. We go to the last scene of the play, and 25 plot complications are tied up in the final scene. All of a sudden, boom, 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 boom. Children find their parents. Parents find their children. The dead come back to life. It's just all, it's, and everyone on the stage is just breathless. This cannot be happening. You mean that you were the wife? Well, that's her daughter. Well, you're our sister? I thought, you mean you were alive all this time? It just boom, 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 boom. And you are left with a sense of having entered a place of the miraculous that is dreamlike and beyond human understanding that has been prepared for all along, but who could have imagined it was possible? And Cymbeline, king of Britain, goes off, he's been fighting the Romans, the ancient Romans, of course, and submits himself to Rome. Because they've been refusing to pay homage to Rome. Well, you can guess what that's all about. 1609, England. And the king finally submits and pays his homage to Rome. He got away with it. It was ancient Rome. It's those old guys. Okay? He got away with it. But it's clear as the nose on your face. And it ends with them all going off together to laud the gods and make sacrifice on the altar to send the smoke up to the gods and tell their stories to each other. It's breathtaking. Everyone says the play is a disaster. I've seen it 5 times, only once as Shakespeare wrote it. They cut, they rearrange, they redo it. It doesn't work. They say, see, the play doesn't work. The one time I saw it where they actually did it the way the man wrote it, it was spectacular, and the audience was left in a state of wonder. Astonishing. Shakespeare knew more about playwriting than a pipsqueak director in the year 2000-whatever. It's crazy. But he also knew more about human life, and he knew more about what is demanded of us, how we must live, and what is necessary to make it to glory. Now when I pray the glorious mysteries, I have a little understanding, thanks to, as Ben Jonson said, my beloved master, Mr. Shakespeare. Thank you very much.